You know ID, ID in the D in the town all day. ID, ID in the D in the F E A. You know ID, ID in the D in the town all day. ID, ID in the D in the F E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 213 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And as usual, we are coming to you from different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of your Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks.
Those are two things we're going to get to this year. And let's remember some years when we do that this week. But up first, we're going to start out with our special guest this week. Will Conroy just completed his fifth season as an assistant coach for the UW men's basketball team after playing for the Huskies from 2001 through 2005, finishing his career as the program's all-time leader in assists and playing 7 years professionally, including with four different NBA teams. But today we wanted to have him on to talk about his role organizing the Our Voices Matter Youth Parent Forum at Renton's Liberty Park that was attended by several prominent members of Seattle's basketball community. NBA players including Jamal Crawford, Spencer Hawes, Zach LaVine, Brandon Roy, and Isaiah Thomas, WNBA MVP Breanna Stewart and her all-star Seattle Storm teammate Jewel Lloyd, UW head coach Mike Hopkins, top high school prospect Paolo Banchero, and former Seahawk Cliff Averill, as well as Mrs. Fantasy Genius. All right, let's get to it. Thanks so much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So kind of just wanted to start with, you know, what were the emotions you went through seeing the horrific video of George Floyd's murder at the hands of the Minneapolis Police Department, and what led from that to organizing this rally?
Well, I think my feelings were just like everyone else's, you know, especially everyone else who you know, of African-American. I felt we watched a horrific it was a horrific sighting. In my opinion, it was a 2020 lynching, and that's how I seen it. So, I was very upset, but I felt like, more importantly, that kids and families in our community needed to have support, and that's kind of what sparked the leadership forum that was put together by me and a couple other guys.
One of the things I wanted to touch on in your speech during that forum, you know, you mentioned that this particularly struck you because of the fact that, of course, you know, the piddling charge here was, you know, passing a fake $20 bill, and that it brought you back mm-hmm. to your mom having to pass checks to get you onto travel teams and things like that. And, you know, one of the things I was curious about was, if that hadn't happened, would you be here? Would you have played in the NBA?
Right. No, I don't think so. I really don't. I don't think that, some of those hard sacrifices and hard decisions that my mom had to make so that we could have opportunities to make those kind of events. Without that, I don't think you get that opportunity to get the notoriety. You don't get to be seen. You don't. You know, it's a lot that goes into it, man. When you come up in a household that's struggling, it's a lot that goes into it. There's a lot of robbing Peter to pay Paul, so to speak. But I mean, I'm not saying this to. I think my mother is one of the most courageous women that you will ever meet. I mean, she is a fighter, and everything that's in her, she's instilled in me. And that's what, when I seen it, it kind of struck me, because I know how many parents, you know, and people have the same story where, you know, their parents just struggled, you know, to make ends meet, but made it happen, figured out a way to make it happen. And this wasn't even during a pandemic when jobs are at a loss. So, with that being said, I just felt like our community, our youth, the next leader of generations, they needed to see the people that they looked up to. Not so much me, but, you know, the Zach Levines of the world, the Breanna Stewart and Jewel Lloyds of the world, and Cliff Averills and Isaiah Thomases and Jamal Crawfords. They needed to see those guys. They needed to hear that we don't have all the answers for you, but we're going through the same thing that you're going through, and we're walking this walk with you. And besides that, you know, we're here for you. We are here for you to touch, be around. We're here to have an ear for you, and I think that's very important.
Who was the first person that you reached out to? Was it Jamal Crawford?
The first person I reached out to was, I think it was Jamal Crawford. Yes, it was. I said that we needed to do something. We needed to move soon. And he was all down for it. But he had brought some great ideas to my mind. He was like, "Well, Will, we can have this, but what comes after that? Just a form and that's it." And at first that's all I was thinking, but he was like, "There has to be something after that. Like there has to be more action," and which prompted me to have another plan after this that we're going to follow through. And, you know, you'll probably hear about it down the line, but it's something along these lines that we're going to continue so we can continue to help grow our next generation of leaders in our communities.
What did it kind of say, you know, when you guys started reaching out to people that you got so much response so quickly from people throughout the Seattle basketball community? I mean, it's, you know, it's every level. It's high school, college, pro, men's, women's, that, you know, everyone kind of wanted to show up and be a part of this.
Mm-hmm. You know what? It showed a lot. It, you know, once we contacted people and told them, you know, what our idea was and what we were trying to do, everyone jumped on board and just said, "How can I be there? When can I be there?" And I mean, no one really said no. Obviously, we're in the middle of a pandemic, and you know, it's not extremely safe for everyone to gather in bunches. But you know, that's why we try to abide by the governor's guidelines as far as having space between each other and having a big field and mask on. And you know, World Vision came through and provided, you know, up to 400 masks and hand sanitizer. So that part of it worked out for us too. But you know, it was a perfect situation in an awful time. And you know, a lot of the local local star athletes, you know, the ones that could make it, they made it without even hesitation. And there was a lot of them who texted me afterwards or sent me a message afterwards, said, "Man, next time you're doing anything like this, let me know. I'll be there." So that's a positive thing.
What was the level of support that you've gotten from your boss at UW, Mike Hopkins, who was one of the people who was there and spoke?
Mm-hmm. It was, you know, he was one of the main contributors to making this happen for me, because he was like, "Don't let that just be a thought of something you want to do. Do it." He was like, "Do it. Don't feel any type of way about it." He was like, "You know, you're a leader of your community." He's like, "People listen to you." He said, "This is a great platform for you, and anything I can do to help you, I will be there." So his support was huge in this deal. And he came out, you know, he was one of the first speakers, and he stayed, and he listened to everyone's story and everyone's time. He stayed the whole time, and, you know, he was inspired, and it's inspired him to even, you know, he's called me every day, and he's done some type of, you know, some type of homework and just kind of trying to learn, you know, things that he was just unaware of. He's really studying it and empathizing with us and trying to figure out a ways to be better and move forward.
That's awesome to hear. Quickly going back to your time as a basketball player, what do you think the differences are in these last little over a decade plus between athletes, maybe when you were playing and now as a coach, and their willingness to speak out on social issues?
I believe everyone, I think social media is a big reason because of that. I mean, everyone is their own reporter. And once you have that type of platform where you can say things and the masses hear you, I think, you know, that's a great thing, and it can be used as an awful thing. So when something like this rings out, you get the best of the best, you know, on every level, you know, that's going to say something. And, you know, when I played, you know, I think back then, I think there was only one, like, I think MySpace had just started. MySpace had just started. So I mean, no one was using MySpace to, you know, make huge statements about what was going on in the world socially or economically or anything like that. But now, like I said, everyone's their own CNN reporter.
Cool. Have you talked to the current team at UW about using the platform that each of them have individually to express how they're feeling?
Oh yeah, for sure. We, I thought Coach Hopkins did an unbelievable job of addressing this kind of right off the bat with our team. We had Dr. Alexis Harris, who specializes in these type of issues. She spoke to our team. She's African American. She spoke to our team, and really what it was an opportunity to let everyone voice their frustrations and how they felt, and we all kind of listened, and we were there for each other, and I think that was a big thing. And moving forward, I think this raises all kind of awareness of where we're lacking all around, in not just our institution, but a lot of institutions that we can be better. And the best thing about our school is our athletic director and our president, they want to be better. They want to be better in these situations. So it was a great beginning, a great start. Hopefully we can see great things happen because of this awful event that happened last week or 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I think that's what we're all hoping. I mean, I also think it's interesting when players kind of share their experiences with law enforcement, where they've perhaps been profiled. And, I know Paolo Banchero, who was one of the people there, shared that story, of him and Noah Williams, who's now at WSU, a situation where they ended up successfully suing law enforcement because of the fact that, you know, they had guns drawn on them. I feel like that, you know, kind of speaks to people who may not, you know, to people who, white people who may not understand, you know, kind of how pervasive this is. And then you also mentioned, you know, during your comments, you know, LeBron James's tweet about how no matter how much money you have, and I think I would also add, no matter how hard you work, no matter how successful you are, you're still seen differently because of your race. I mean, do you see that kind of resonating with people?
Oh yeah, 100%. I think that I think why it's such a powerful movement right now in 2020 is because you have people that aren't African American who are putting it on the line for African Americans, and that's why it's so powerful right now, because you see these protests happening all over the country, shoot, all over the world, and they're not all African American. And I think once that starts to happen, we start to get movement and moving forward. And a big thing that one of the things that you keep seeing come across Twitter is, you know, when you're talking about athletics, as you see that, you know, a lot of athletes, former athletes felt like, did my college only love me because I was a good player? Mm-hmm. What about after that? You know what I mean? That's a big thing, like, you know, making sure that the players are, you know, are educated and they're not just at college or in these major institutions to be entertainment. And that's a big thing, because if you look at it, it's like, like in a way lesser scale, it's just like, you know, go do your thing, go play the game. We'll clap for you. We'll do all that for you, and then go back to being whatever you are. But you know, you're not on this level socially as us, and that's where we have to educate our athletes, educate our communities to where, no, we are socially just as equal. Like we are, so. That's a big piece of the education piece that, you know, we got to get our noses in these books, and we got to study and we got to learn. And that's going to be a big piece moving forward. And especially with the athletes that we're coaching, we got to make them feel like there's more besides basketball. And then the people that they're dealing with that's in the university, we got to make sure they're not dealing with people who are just looking at them as, all right, do your 4 years here and then go on and back to entertain us for 4 years and then go on and do your thing. And I'm like, this would have to be like a lifetime deal. So that's kind of my take on that.
You know, one of the things I was curious about all the time at UW games, you know, I see your kids playing on, there's like a little hoop that's underneath the bleachers down below, just in case one of the hoops gets pulled down, and they're always playing on that afterwards, you know, while media is doing interviews. What have your conversations been like with them about, you know, what they saw with George Floyd and the reaction to it?
There's been some hard truth. I think there's no way around it. You know, you've got to kind of prepare. You know, you never want to take your child's innocence away. You never want to expose him to or hurt to things that like can deter their innocence. But you know, it's all over everywhere. So there's some hard conversations that's had to be had, and what you can do is you can educate them, and you can, you know, make them aware of, you know, because my son and my daughter, they don't see color. I mean, they've got you know, some of my former teammates. I can just use it, Mike Jensen for an example. You know, me and him are still really close. My son and his son call each other cousins. They don't know no better, you know. So when something like this happens, you're like, Dad, what's this about? And then, you know, you try to explain it to him as delicate as possible without shading his mind on how he sees the world, if that makes sense. So, yeah, there's been hard conversations, but you know, I think that, you know, I've seen this go across a few Twitter lines, is racism is taught or it's not taught. You know, so that's kind of my feelings on that.
Or you sort of mentioned, you know, that conversation with Jamal about making this more than just the forum, and mentioned a possible, you know, leadership academy, sort of mentoring, that sort of thing during the forum. Has that started to take shape at all? Is there an outline for where you want to go from here?
Oh yeah, it's definitely taking shape. Right now we're just in the beginning process of trying to figure out the ages that we want to service, so to speak, and the curriculums. We also need a location, so you know, and I need to sit down with a few people who have things like this already going, and just kind of, you know, get a guideline of, you know, I don't want to, we're not trying to steal anything from them, but we're trying to expand on probably what they've done and take it to another level. So, I think, you know, and I said this during my speech, and sometimes it's not the message, it's the messenger. So, you know, a lot of people have great leadership and mentor programs, but you know, if you have a mentoring program with Jamal Crawford in it, or Isaiah Thomas in it, or, you know, whoever else in it, I think, you know, that message coming from them is powerful. And people will want to be a part of that, and kids will want to be a part of that. And it don't have to just be about sports. You know, I think with the resources that, you know, some of the guys that we can configure have, that, you know, there's no roof that you could put on it. You know, there's anybody that you could have come into one of these mentoring meetings. You know, we can bring anybody from any platform in and speak to our kids and these kids. And I think that holds great weight in what we're trying to do.
Well, look forward to hearing more details as that starts to come together. And, you know, would love to have you back to talk about it as it becomes a reality.
Oh yeah, it's going to, it's going to come a reality. My mind is set on that, so you can guarantee it.
Yeah, we appreciate that. I mean, thanks so much for taking the time to join us, and thanks for doing everything that you've done.
Thanks, Will.
No problem. Thanks for having me, guys.
Great stuff from Will. Really glad to have him on. And now we'll get to our usual business, starting with this week's beer, is promised. We are going to begin going through and having the listener drink along with us and as we advertised last week, that's going to start with Mac and Jack's African Amber, a beer that until now, much like Canny's, you had been only able to drink at home if you got a growler or something of that nature. Here's the messaging on there. A message from the King of Beasts, the lion on the front of the African Amber cans. Well, I am normally the strong and silent type. The time has come for me to speak. The brewery tanks are full and my heart is heavy. Since our favorite watering holes are closed, it is time for me to leave my den and come to you. I want to help my hurting friends in the hospitality industry that have supported me for 26 years. A portion of the proceeds of this limited can release will be donated to help them in their time of need. Be safe and be healthy.
So how long is this going to be lasting for? Is there a specific timeline like there is with the Manny's in the cans? Or is this just an unnamed limited release?
If there is, I haven't seen it, but I'm going to double check on their website here.
Have you seen, this is a question, there are a lot of folks on Twitter who asked about find the Amber, and it seems like it might only be located in places that have a little bit better beer selection. Might not be in every single Safeway or location like that. QFCs typically do have better selections of beers, and heard that they had that at a couple of locations in the North End.
I don't know if it's necessarily that. I mean, I think it's probably just a matter of where the distribution is, because so, you know, they have a finder on their website. They don't say specifically how long it's going to be, although it may not be that much longer, because we're seeing a lot of not necessarily full-on bars, but locations that have patios, things like that, like Chuck's Hop Shop, for example, are starting to reopen now as we move to a modified phase one, a phase 1.5 here in King County. But it says it's in a lot of these locations. Like it said, it was at the local Safeways that I went to and did not find it. So maybe it will eventually be there. I don't know.
Well, that's my question for you is, have you seen Canny's in a grocery store?
No, I did not see that when I went out looking either. So
I haven't either. Yeah,
I think Mac and Jack's started canning a little bit earlier than Georgetown started canning Manny's. But again, may just be a matter of the distribution catching up.
All right. Well, hold on for a second, because we'd heard that these taste better in glasses. So I have to go get a glass, actually.
I did try it out of the can earlier. I normally pour beer whenever I drink it at home into a glass. I got to be honest, I don't know that I really noticed a difference.
I'm not really a big Mac and Jack's guy. Actually, it's tasting pretty good. I don't know. Are we supposed to be judging these beers as if they clear the bar of Rainier? Like, if Rainier is the belt holder... I mean, I mentioned to you that I think we need a couple of different categories because Rainier is a specific type of beer. But if the threshold is Manny's, Mac and Jack's is definitely not clearing that bar.
That's a tough bar to clear. I agree. I don't think that should be the bar.
Maybe it's Manny's on one end and Rainier on the other end.
So you've got four categories. You're better than Manny's, between Manny's and Rainier. And then worse than Rainier?
No, it's more like if it's an American lager, you're competing with Rainier.
I see.
Or if it's a like a microbrew, as they would say, as our forebears would say, then you're competing with Manny's.
Are we going to be drinking a lot of American lagers on this podcast going forward?
No, so Rainier always wins.
Okay, that does check out. We're going to keep toying with this. I mean, this is the first week that hopefully people, to the extent that they can find Mac and Jack's, will be drinking along. But it's funny that you say that you're not a big fan of it, because it is our mom's single favorite beer. And she is known for her beer palate.
And being able to pronounce Mac and Jack's.
Okay, we don't have any toast this week, but I wanted to discuss with you the all-time State of Washington squad exercise that our friends at the Goaltending Podcast with former UW legend Donald Watts, as well as my friend Matt McKay, who's an NBA scout, put together. So they,
how long have they been doing this podcast?
A few weeks here, I think.
Okay, I'm a little bit disappointed they didn't ask me to co-host, but it's okay.
Wait, why?
I like that you asked that in earnestness.
Well, you didn't say us to co-host. You said you to co-host.
No, no, just me. You asked me to co-host, so I feel like...
We're going to get... I don't know. I don't know if I asked you to co-host. We'll get to that later, though. So it's the traditional format. You have $15 to build your team with players of $5, $4, $3, $2, $1. Now, what makes this interesting is, number one, because it's the state of Washington, literally all of these players are guards. And then number two, it's not entirely clear what kind of game we're building them for, because I think it's different if we're playing a crossover game than if we're playing an NBA game. But, you know, there wasn't any context for that, so I just had to go without that.
You just have to build your squad. Okay, so before we get into this, I'm guessing that what they used to find players from Washington State was the Wikipedia of basketball players from Washington State.
Why do you say that?
Because there's one glaring omission that I saw in both. Okay. And that is a small forward from the University of Washington, from Germany, named Detlef Schrempf.
Yeah, I don't know if he counts. I mean...
Played high school basketball in Washington State. What is the difference?
Avery Bradley played his high school basketball in Nevada because he transferred for like his last 2 years. I mean, he had previously played with Abdul Gaddy, I believe, at Bellarmine Prep. I still think he counts. I think it's more based on where you grew up than specifically where you went to high school.
I'm just saying it wasn't like he just played at UW. I'm going to check. Wait, who is that? Who you said? Avery Bradley?
Yes.
Who is on that list? Yes. I think that they use this Wikipedia as the starting point, and Detlef Schrempf is incorrectly not listed on this Wikipedia. The only player who I was scrolling through it who I was like, oh, I could see them being included if this is what you're using as the starting point is Michael Porter Jr., who's not on there. I agree that I don't think Michael, I wouldn't really consider him a Washington State basketball player.
I mean, because he only played one more year than Detlef did.
But Detlef also went to UW.
I don't know if that, yeah, I guess so.
Detlef is a fixture. He went to UW. He played for the Sonics. Like, Detlef is a fixture of Washington State basketball in a way that Michael Porter Jr. Transferred here for one season and then left.
I wasn't expecting to bog down on this particular.
Well, then you shouldn't have argued against Detlef. You should have just said yes, Detlef should have been on it.
I mean, fine. It would have been reasonable if Detlef were on there. It didn't stand out to me as clear that he wasn't.
Anyway, this, you know, we've seen a lot of these things pop up in the last couple of months here. This is the single hardest one I have had to do. I haven't had to do any of them. The single hardest one I have chosen to do of any of these.
So to me, like, again, especially if you're trying to build an NBA team, it's really important to get quality big men, and there's not a lot of options. So to me, Marvin Williams is actually maybe the easiest choice on here.
What? Okay, first off, you of all people said it's really important to get quality big men. You're the person who single-handedly is costing big men in the NBA millions of dollars.
I'm going cheaper at center with Spencer Hawes, who's $2. But Marvin Williams, he's like a modern, versatile player.
Okay. Wow, you went with Big Marv. I mean, to me, do you want to run through your entire team and then I'll run through mine? Or...
Okay, so I took Nate Robinson at point guard because, you know, him at $3 I thought was a
better value. We have very different teams.
I mean, that's what part of the fun of this is you can go a lot of different directions with these players.
And say how much these players cost. Because you had Marvin Williams is $4. Nate is $3. Spencer Hawes is $2. So you're at $9 right now.
And Brandon Roy is a $5 player. He was the one guy I took from that tier because I do think the difference between him and the next level of shooting guards is pretty substantial. And then I rounded out my team at the $1 level with Matisse Thybulle.
Okay. So we have three of the same players. To me, I started out on the $5 line. A lot of times I'm just like, I want stars and then I want cheap players. John Stockton, it's NBA Hall of Famer. Like, initially I was like, well, I want Isaiah and I want B-Roy. But if I'm thinking about this honestly, I don't like John Stockton more. I wouldn't be more excited to have him on my team. But as the only Hall of Famer, NBA Hall of Famer on this list, I feel like who did it for 20 years, like...
Well, I don't feel like 20 of the 20 years. You're not building a franchise in NBA 2K.
Well,
here.
So I went and checked that also. And John Stockton's peaks are significantly better than Isaiah Thomas's. I mean, like...
They're better. I don't know if they're significantly better.
By what measure? Because I went to the old Basketball Reference and looked up the advanced stats. And, I mean, Stockton has years that are like, Isaiah has one really good year. Like, it's just, I don't want
to
say
To me, when we do an exercise like this, you're getting the very best version. Bill Simmons in the Book of Basketball called it, like, the vintage. You get the best year of that player.
Yeah, so I'm taking Stockton. Like,
completely fair. I mean, I certainly consider, I just thought there was more depth at point guard.
So I went Stockton and B-Roy right there. So, I mean, that's $10 gone. And then, of course, Tease. And as for a dollar, it's a steal, right?
Well, very appropriately for Matisse Thybulle for it to be a steal.
So then I was basically like, I could do... I had $4 to work with. So I'm like, I could do another 1-3. The $3 players, none of them really looked that good to me, though. It's Michael Dickerson, Nate Robb, Avery Bradley, Rodney Stuckey, and DeJounte. And I'm like, well, I don't need a point guard, right? Which a lot of I just don't need any of what those players are bringing to the table. And I rounded it out with two $2 players and getting some shooting in Martell Webster. And then I didn't want to do it, but had to, with Spencer Hawes as the big man.
Spencer Hawes.
I can't believe he ended up on both of our teams. It's just that he's the only cheap, decent big. I mean, that $3 line, there's so many guards everywhere else. And, like, you've got a defensive stopper in Matisse, so you don't need Avery Bradley.
Some other interesting players who could have been considered. You could have had Steve Hawes in there as a big man. Bob Hoobriggs, who is the other Hall of Famer from the state of Washington besides John Stockton. Led the Huskies to the Final Four in 1953, their only appearance. There's not really a whole lot else.
Yeah, I feel really good about the state of Washington in basketball. And then I looked at this and I was like, huh, okay. It's like a lot of similar type of players, you know, like
yes.
Isaiah, Jason Terry, Jamal Crawford, like they do a lot of pretty similar type of things.
100%. Yeah, we're very good at developing guards and just no big men.
I went and looked up what Joe Harris's stats too, just to be like, should I be going Joe Harris here over Spencer Hawes? But he's much shorter than I thought he was.
Yeah. Yeah,
I love that Adam Morrison reached the $2 line. Like,
I mean, this also depends on, like, are we talking NBA? Are we talking college? Lots of options here.
When the Paulo being included was pretty impressive. Or I was thinking about, as far as touted players, and maybe he's higher than some of these players, but, like, I mean, we saw a couple of very big ones. Or we saw a very big one from the state on the Huskies last year. And then there's like Tony Roten coming out of high school was a massive player. Like there have been a lot of very big players coming out of high school from Washington State who may not have panned out to be like amazing stars. But I thought Paulo was kind of interesting being included.
Yeah, definitely.
Kevin Porter Jr. is not affiliated with Michael Porter Jr., right? He's not related.
Well, that'd be very hard for there to be... I mean, I guess they could be cousins.
It'd
be
brothers that are both juniors.
No, they are not related.
You have fun with your... My team is beating yours.
Are
two different players. I'm swapping out John Stockton for Nate Robb and
Martell Webster. Yeah.
I like my odds.
When you put it that way, it doesn't sound great.
I mean, that's just, it's a lot of money to pay for Marvin Williams as a $4 player.
I just think the drop off, because, you know, Marvin Williams is going to have time in the post with whoever he is, Martell Webster, whoever's guarding him from your team.
We'll put Tease at the four. Tease could defend.
Strength is not his strong suit.
But imagine us spreading it out, too. You got Stockton, B-Roy, Martell Webster, and Tease in the corner, shooting the three.
The other thing about Stockton and Roy is, like, Roy's best attribute is having playing with the ball in his hands. So you are kind of minimizing that if you play him with Stockton.
Spencer Hawes, John Stockton, pick and rolls.
Devastating. should we get to the update on restart plans?
Absolutely.
So not a whole lot new on the NBA front. One interesting thing that was clarified by my ESPN colleague Tim Bontemps over the weekend is that in cases where teams have different number of games and the league is just going to is not going to be go by like games back, it's just going to go by straight winning percentage. So this is actually a huge advantage for the Blazers in the restart, because they, I think we talked about this last week, have the record that is 1/1000th of a percent better than New Orleans and Sacramento, and that means that unless they both go 8-0, those two teams have to have a better record in over the final eight games than the Blazers do to make the play-in game over them.
Interesting. So the Blazers are in not a bad situation heading into this.
Yeah, I mean, I still think New Orleans is the favorite to force that play-in game, but you know, the Blazers will be right there in that mix. Baseball, the league and players continue to be at odds over their plan for potentially playing this season, but we're going to have the MLB draft starting on Wednesday.
Great.
And pick sixth, their highest pick since taking Alex Jackson at the same spot in 2014. This year's draft will be just 5 rounds due to the pandemic and the fact that there is not expected to be minor league baseball this season.
Interesting. Alex Jackson, do we know where he is?
He made his major league debut, I think it was last year in Atlanta. It has not really panned out as a...
He's not on the Mariners anymore.
He was, I mean, he was traded while he was still a prospect, but has not really panned out into anything long term.
I have never once heard that name before. We probably covered it on a Pelton Cast at some point. I probably have heard it, but...
Apparently he's a catcher. I didn't realize that. He played 4 games last year for the Braves at age 23.
Oh, I see. He's not too old.
Yeah, he's still got a chance. He was drafted out of high school. The Sounders anticipate approval for full training within the next week. Currently in phase two of the MLS return to play, which allows players to pass the ball back and forth, but they still have to remain distanced while doing so.
They're able to pass the ball back and forth from a distance.
Assuming it happens on that timeline, would give the Sounders somewhere between a week and a half to 2 weeks of training in Seattle before heading to Orlando for the MLS tournament.
Okay.
The OL Reign preparing for the NWSL Challenge Cup, continuing to train in Missoula before heading to the Salt Lake City area for that one. In the WNBA, ESPN's Vishal Vopal reported that the league is proposing a 22-game season at IMG Academy in Bradenton, Florida, with the hope of starting play on July 24th. Still some question about whether that's going to be pulled off, though. Ari Chambers, who covers the league, posted a thread today on Twitter saying that she'd spoken with several players who feel like they aren't being heard and have concerns about, you know, the level of accommodations, if they're being quarantined for several months there, because this season would run, I think, through October, and having to accept 60% of their salary for this season, because obviously there would be no fans, no tickets sold for this. So we'll see whether this actually comes together. And it's a more aggressive timetable. You'll note that the NBA, they're planning to play starting July 31st. They've already announced this plan. The WNBA, which has not announced a plan, is hoping to play a week earlier.
Yeah. I mean, the NBA is having a very unaggressive timetable, I would say. So all sports are going to be in Orlando, basically.
There's going to be a lot. Well, they'd be in Bradenton, Florida, so that's not actually in Orlando.
Okay. They're all going to be in the state of Florida.
Other than the NWSL. That's the only one that, at this point, is not there. UW football.
Let me ask you before we get there, if you've heard of any of these three people involved in this Alex Jackson trade. So
I looked it up.
Okay.
So maybe I remember their names, and maybe I don't, because it was two days ago.
He was traded for righties Rob Whalen and Max Poves.
Oh, maybe I didn't look this up.
Are the Mariners gotten the deal?
I do not know those people.
Maybe the fourth player involved might be the one you've heard of. Player to be named later.
Oh, I love player to be named later. Yeah. Always. Always. You know, I have a player to be named later jersey.
Oh, yeah.
UW targeting June 15th for return of athletes to campus. Workouts would initially be limited to 5 players at most in a group. As previously reported, all players will be tested both for active COVID-19 infections and antibodies. And there's also a possibility, if things, go smoothly, that by the end of June you could have the entire football team back on campus prepping for a possible fall camp.
And that's because of what phase they could be in?
The maximum of five?
Well, you talked about by the end of June. Like, so if Washington enters phase three, then you could have the entire team. Or you could have the entire team, you're saying, and just only training five at a time.
Correct. Yeah, that would be the situation until probably they start fall camp. Like,
God.
On the NFL side, it sounds like players are not going to be allowed back in facilities until the start of training camp.
Late July, August.
Although coaches now are back in the facilities. They're allowed to host their off-season Zoom calls, that sort of thing, from there. You know, so one thing I would say, like I mentioned that MLS, you know, the Sounders, they're potentially being approved for full training. That would be ahead of King County going to phase two. I think the idea is that, you know, in situations where these leagues and teams are testing on a regular basis, that what you're going to be allowed to do might be a little bit different than what you and I can do in terms of, you know, we can't go out and play basketball or play football, but, you know, in a controlled environment that's allowed.
I mean, I suppose it makes sense. With the amount of attention that's being paid to every individual athlete.
Right. There's more safeguards in place than there are, you know, if you're just going to play a random pickup game. On the Seahawks front, Carlos Hyde, newly signed running back, was introduced to Seattle media via Zoom, said that after having off-season shoulder surgery, he should be ready for the start of training camp and will be ready for week one. That's good, but also the whole reason they're signing him is because Rashad Penny is coming back off an injury, and so is Chris Carson. And it's kind of funny that, you know, Hyde might not be 100% right away either.
This is DJ Dallas's backfield.
The disrespect to Travis over it is noted. Hyde also said, you know, kind of, what could the NFL do to prove it's serious about, you know, we had the Roger Goodell statement last week. Admitting mistakes in terms of preventing players from protesting, and his answer was simple and understandable, is that his former teammate Colin Kaepernick should be signed.
Now, do you think, in this moment, do you think the Seahawks should sign Colin Kaepernick, were he to be interested?
Yeah. I mean, why not?
Absolutely.
I mean, look, we haven't seen Colin Kaepernick play football in 3.5 years now. I think it's very possible that given the time away, that Geno Smith is a better quarterback right now than Colin Kaepernick. But I'm pretty sure the motto is not like, hey, you know, maybe only compete when it's convenient. I don't think that's the motto. Only compete when it's politically palatable.
I mean, it kind of is the motto, for being honest. Like, there's a history of this. It's not, I think, in this particular scenario, the Seahawks are guilty of only competing when it was convenient. But, I mean, it seemed like when they talked to Colin Kaepernick years ago now, he was willing and interested in signing. And, you know, I think the part that gets lost in this along the way is, you know, Colin Kaepernick doesn't have to sign just because somebody's interested in him. It does, given the workout that he had this last year. It seems like Colin Kaepernick wants to play football in the NFL. And I would say that if he was ever going to be signed anywhere, it's going to be this offseason at some point. I think the stigma that NFL teams saw around Colin Kaepernick is just, it's gone, you know?
I mean, as we talked about last week with DJ Infrared, just the center on this issue has changed so dramatically within the past, you know, I would say 4 years, but it's even within the less than 3 years since this issue was ignited during the 2017 season by the president's comments about it. We've seen just a dramatic shift. Now Drew Brees is calling out the president for his comments on kneeling. So, well, you know, It's a time.
I mean, I would be so stoked if the Seahawks signed Kaepernick, you know, and it's like, I don't. They don't have. Is Geno Smith under contract at the moment?
Yeah.
Or is he still a free agent?
They signed him a few weeks ago.
Okay, so Geno Smith is under contract, but again, it is an opportunity to compete, especially for that backup position. We've talked about this over and over and over again. That God forbid, knock on wood, something should happen to Russell Wilson.
Decides to quit to become a backup dancer for Sierra.
Uh-huh. You feel not that bad about the team with Kaepernick under center. I mean, he hasn't played for quite a few years, but like Colin Kaepernick at his peak, I mean, he played in a Super Bowl, played in an NFC Championship game that we're going to be talking about later.
Sure will. Very shortly, we'll be talking about it. I mean, it's interesting. I went and re-listened to the podcast we did right after 2017 when they declined to sign him and signed at that point Austin Davis. I don't think this is going to backup option as Geno Smith.
That right there is the Seahawks being guilty of only picking when they feel like it's only competing when they feel like it's convenient.
But we weren't really all that critical in that podcast because our opinion was, well, Kaepernick probably wants to be a starter. He expects to be a starter. He's probably going to get a starting job at some other point because there will be an injury or something will happen. And it's really only with the benefit of hindsight that we've realized, like, no one else was going to give him that shot. That shot wasn't coming. And, you know, if he was going to be in the league, it was going to be as a backup.
We had too much faith in the NFL.
Often guilty of that, I'm certain.
Okay, can we talk about, on top of this, I mean, I hope that we're talking about news in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, that the Seahawks or some NFL team has signed Colin Kaepernick. There's still NFL teams that don't have quality starters, let alone backups. Can we also talk about your colleagues at ESPN doing basically a mock draft of the NFL?
Yeah.
Do you have
Russell Wilson going number 2 overall?
And Russell Wilson going pick 2. You had some thoughts on Russ being drafted pick 2.
Yeah, I thought it was actually too high for him. I mean, the respect is noted. The respect is appreciated. But if the idea is you're drafting them for the rest of their career, it's basically like you're running a Madden draft where you can reset all the rosters and you get to draft out your own team to start a franchise. And in that scenario, I do think you have to go with Lamar Jackson, Dak Prescott, and probably Deshaun Watson over Russ, given their age.
I'm looking up the difference in age between Lamar Jackson and... Oh, wow, God, he's young.
And Russell Wilson?
Jesus Christ.
It's really substantial.
I mean, I think, oh, good God, man, Lamar Jackson is really young. Russ has a solid 10 years left in him as an NFL quarterback.
I sure hope so. I think that, 5 years ago you might have said that Aaron Rodgers has a good 10 years left in him, and now it doesn't look like that, no, does it?
I mean, I don't know. Maybe Rodgers wasn't that good 5 years ago. I don't know if Rodgers' decline is just because of age.
I mean, I don't know about just because of age, but age is a pretty big factor.
I'm willing to listen. I just think Lamar Jackson and the way that
he was coming off a season where he had just led the NFL in adjusted yards per attempt.
For Lamar Jackson, Mahomes is an obvious number one, undisputed. I would want more of a history with Lamar Jackson. He had one excellent season. It's a very particular kind of offense that you're running with Lamar Jackson, and probably still need to run with Lamar Jackson. I'm not fully convinced that he will be able to recreate that season into the future. Russell Wilson has done it over and over and over again. Obviously, Lamar Jackson is promised, and to me, he's very high. Watson is one who... if there wasn't an injury history, I would say that I probably would choose. I mean, not personally, but objectively speaking, I would probably choose over Russ. And then Dak at the same. I think Dak. It's close. I mean, those are the ones.
It's a joke that you would take Russ number 2.
If you give me any choice here. I mean, I think Joe Burrow is an interesting one if we're talking about, although he's probably older than Lamar Jackson. I would guess. And then Kyler is another one, where, like, Kyler Murray went 17 after Drew Lock.
The Drew Lock choice was really something. He went number 15 to the Broncos.
John Elway was drafting for the Broncos, right?
It was weird when he went to Jacob Eason in the third round.
And still a running back going in the top 20. I understand that Christian McCaffrey is a bit of a hybrid running back, but come on. Oh, we saw Christian McCaffrey on the Panthers with no quarterback.
That team ended up with Bobby Wagner in the second round. DK Metcalf went in the fourth round.
Really?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool to see.
Yeah. Did Tyler Lockett get picked? Tyler Lockett was the final pick of the fourth
round. Green Bay drafted a kicker?
Wait, what?
Somebody, who was it? I've got to see this Green Bay team. Justin Tucker. Wow,
They sure did.
Oh, my God. Tua, David Bakhtiari, Darius Slay, and Justin Tucker. They drafted a quarterback who has never played a game, an offensive lineman, a cornerback, and a kicker. I think maybe the actual Packers were doing the drafting there.
Oh, boy.
Wow. That's really funny. It definitely is like drafting a punter ahead of Russell Wilson.
That was last year. We're not remembering that anymore.
Who did the Seahawks end up with? Not that it really matters, but did Brady Henderson draft for the Seahawks?
Yes, third Pelton brother Brady Henderson was on the draft. He took Mike Evans with the 27th pick, Jalen Ramsey at number 38. Ben Roethlisberger at 91, and DeMarcus Lawrence at 102.
Not sure about that draft either. I would have taken Kaepernick over Ben Roethlisberger. Anyway, I saw it, and I was very impressed with the respect that Russell Wilson got. It made me think, you know, Russ has been an MVP candidate quite a bit, but I don't think it's ever been that close, and it's partially because people keep having historic seasons. You know, Pat Mahomes has a historic season. Lamar Jackson has a historic season.
Right.
Russell Wilson's just consistently extremely good.
Yeah. Ben Baldwin has been posting some updated QB stats now that his model goes back several seasons and has been further developed. And Russ isn't like in one of the top 10 seasons by quarterbacks, but then if you, you know, sum up the last four or five seasons, he's like second.
Yeah. And that totally makes sense.
Yeah.
And that's why he goes number two. I mean, the thing is, you know, Lamar Jackson has an MVP caliber season, but the chances of him being, I would say the chances of him being worse than Russ statistically next year are probably 75% or higher. It's, you know, it's a significant percentage. The chances of him having a worse season next season than Russ. Mahomes is the only one who I'm like, as long as he's healthy, will be better than Russell Wilson.
That's probably reasonable.
So, but I was impressed by the respect, and it makes me think that if he has another very high quality season and there isn't sort of like an outlier season, like an amazing Mahomes year, or there's even Mahomes fatigue, I think Russell Wilson could win the MVP at some point in the next 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, the one question is whether his defense is going to be good enough and the Seahawks run-pass ratio is going to be good enough for him to do
that. Or his defense is going to be bad enough.
That's also a fair point. Also a fair point. Well, should we talk about a really good Seahawks defense and a really good Seahawks offense? It's time. Let's remember 2013, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci are champions, and so are the Seahawks in 2013. But before then, there's more important news that happened in the year 2013.
Well, we should talk about Pagliacci for a second, because they have been fundraising champions. Been paying attention to this?
Not really, no.
They originally started out, I think, with a plan to match $10,000 in donations to community passageways, which works to create alternatives to incarceration for youth and young adults and is kind of an alternative to the traditional justice system, which I think is something all of us are looking to right now.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So they originally started out with this goal of $10,000. They donated $10,000, would match up to an additional $10,000. And then people kept donating. Like, when we donated last week, they were just past $10,000. Now they are up to $53,742.
Are you kidding?
With, and they have, between the owners of Pagliacci and then, let's see, who else jumped in here? Our friends at Merlino Foods.
Really? The Merlinos?
Literally, our family friends at Merlino Foods.
Wow.
Added, chipped in another $5,000 in matching funds. So now they are matching up to $55,000 if they can get there. I mean,
wow.
It's just wild.
God, look at Pagliacci.
Also, Pagliacci is still doing excellent pizza. I went there earlier this evening, wanted to get the barbecue chicken again before the seasonals changed over. And tonight, so they're regularly doing this where you buy a pizza and some other local partner, you get something from them. In this case, it was a 2-pack of cookies from Hello Robin, which is great because Hello Robin
so
isn't open right now.
Ugh, God, I want those cookies.
Yeah, it's a pretty awesome deal.
Have we talked about? I know we're talking about Pagliacci. I think Specialties may have closed forever.
Yes, that is the case.
And we haven't done an RIP to Specialties.
No, you have not.
Anyway, carry on.
Yeah, one of the competitors for Seattle's Best Cookie, although they're a chain, so it wasn't quite the same. Saturday, that community giveaway will be salted caramels from Franz Chocolate.
I want the Hello Robin cookies.
I mean, it may technically not be too late. You still have until 11. if we wrap up this podcast really quick enough here.
The last time that I went, I got some hard candies from, I can't remember where.
Could it have also been Franz Chocolate?
No, it was definitely, I would remember Franz Chocolate.
All right.
It's a pretty notable brand.
Anyways, great stuff from Pagliacci.
The people's champ on the streets in Seattle, guiding the way during the protests that are happening on Capitol Hill, at the same time supporting important organizations, finding alternatives to youth imprisonment. Pagliacci does it all, and they have good pizza.
Just on top of everything else. Okay, so the most important thing that happened in 2013.
Yes.
The debut of the fabulous Pelton cast. And we have a clip from the opening episode. The sound quality, it's not great. We were literally recording it on my phone back then.
Hello and welcome to the inaugural edition of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm Kevin Pelton, one of your co-hosts here, a NBA analyst for ESPN Insider and Seattle sports fan. And with me is my brother Tristan.
And that's Tristan Caracino. Not to be confused, I started as a Pelton and then became a Caracino when I was older. That sounds really weird. But anyway, Tristan Caracino, nay Pelton.
You had actually sent me an email or a G-chat earlier. I looked this up and said, do you know how to record a podcast? And I was like, well, no.
Still don't.
Oh, I think we've learned a thing or two in the last 7 years, good sir.
Not that much. Hello?
I mean, the origin of the podcast is like you, this wasn't in the chat transcripts, it must have been in phone conversations, but you bugging me to do a podcast.
For a long time, I feel like. We had the idea way before this that we wanted to record a podcast. It took months to come along.
This can be told from the quality of the production on that first episode.
A lot more about content than we did about recording.
There was a lot of fantasy talk back then, and a lot of tailgating talk.
We imagined, I mean, things evolve over time. That's the good thing. You listen to what people are interested in, what you're interested in talking about, and things evolve. And then you do Mariners hot takes.
Still a highlight. Well, anyways, part of the reason
it was mostly about, we were having these conversations basically every day, every couple of days or whatever. I'd be driving home from work or whatever, or we'd be talking and just talking about sports in general. that are happening around us. And a lot of those conversations did fixate on fantasy and still do sometimes. It's more like we just don't talk about the general sports stuff that we talk about here, but during football season, we'll talk about fantasy while we're just talking to each other. And it was like, you know, as we do still, every conversation, we're like, this is gold.
Save it for the pod.
We're like, this is such great content. Other people need to hear this content. And then decided to record it. And you may happen to have a bit of a platform as an ESPN writer, happen to have a bit of a platform. And here we are today, including our, in 2014, are we going to talk about the end of the Pelton cast?
I'm still not sure what to say there.
Our year and a half long feud because of fantasy football. Our 2.5 year long feud because of fantasy football.
So part of the reason we were so excited to do a podcast in 2013, we talked about this last week. This is the most excited we've ever been about the Seattle Seahawks. That summer of 2013, leading up to the 2013 season, the Seahawks, after going, you know, having the number one DVOA during Russell Wilson's rookie year, losing at Atlanta at the buzzer, then go out and add Cliff Avril, who we just talked about earlier, as still a fixture in the Seattle community, and Michael Bennett as free agents to this team. That also was the year they added Percy Harvin, right?
Absolutely, it is.
I remember the Percy Harvin, I was on a flight. I was getting ready to fly to, I guess I must have been going to the Sloan Conference at that point. And I remember going to I was flying through Minneapolis. I was connecting there. So I went through was looking in the team store at Percy Harvin Vikings gear that they still had there because they hadn't gotten rid of it yet.
This was definitely an offseason where, you know, in the NFC, not championship game, in the NFC division round game against the Falcons, the pass rush, you know, Bruce Irvin was super young. They had, oh my God, pass rusher got injured.
Chris Clemens
had gotten injured
it
in the Washington
game
in the week beforehand.
Nothing was the same, I should say, for 2013.
There we go. Thank you. And it felt like, in hindsight, this is a very Seahawks thing to do, but at the time they were really good at it. There are years that they've been not so good at this, where they're like, we have a problem, we need to over-address it. And pass rush is really not a problem that you can ever over-address. And they managed to go out and find value in two relatively young pass rushers. That is something that is just not that easy to do, and that they managed to do it twice with Michael Bennett and Cliff Avril.
The rest of the NFL screwed up. Let's be clear here. They messed up, and it was to the Seahawks' benefit.
Yeah, but the Seahawks went out and found value. I mean, they did go out this past offseason and pick up Jadeveon Clowney for very little, but like they locked up Avril and Bennett for multi-year contracts. At these low numbers.
Wait, were they multi-year contracts?
Incredible. I think they were both at least 2-year contracts.
Huh. I feel like they re-signed those guys pretty quickly or extended them pretty quickly.
It was a coup that you would have. And also, just like the rest, like you mentioned, the rest of the NFL fucking up.
Yeah, one year, $5 million for Michael Bennett.
Oh, okay, so then they re-upped him after that first year. Yeah. It's still relatively good number.
Yes. Cliff Avril did get 2 years, $15 million.
God, that is absurd. Yeah. That they got those players for those numbers.
It's
but the rest of the NFL,
and they also had like so much cap space because they had Russ as a starting quarterback making peanuts.
Letting the best defense in the NFL go out and sign Cliff Avril and Michael Bennett, and they just came in fully tooled. Like this team, they didn't need Percy Harvin, but they just went and got Percy Harvin because fuck it. It was really the mentality, I think, at the time. And we've seen teams do this, and it didn't. This particular transaction didn't work out for the Seahawks. They managed to win the Super Bowl, so it doesn't matter. But we've seen it over and over and over again where teams say to themselves, this is our window. we need to do everything we can do in this particular time period. And if it means going out and giving up future draft capital, we have got to go and make sure we win a Super Bowl this year. And, I mean, Percy Harvin scored a touchdown in the Super Bowl.
We'll get there. So the Seahawks opened the season with a 12-7 win at Carolina, really kind of a prototypical Seahawks-Panthers game. We didn't know it yet at that point. That was the one where – who's the guy who scored the touchdown?
For the Seahawks?
Yeah.
It was
a receiver who had a big training camp. We were very excited about him. They threw it was back-to-back deep shots to the end zone. The first one Kirst couldn't come up with. And Stephen, no, it wasn't Stephen Williams, I guess. No, maybe I'm misremembering.
I want to call
before?
David
Kirst,
Moore.
Oh, maybe Stephen Williams didn't come up with it, and then Kirst did, because it was Kirst
Stephen
who scored the touchdown.
Williams?
Yeah, Stephen Williams was the guy.
I did not expect to have forgotten a player who was playing on the Super Bowl team. Stephen Williams.
I mean, he didn't last that entire season.
Also did not have a catch in that game.
No, it was I had it backwards. Kirst was the one who caught the touchdown. They threw the deep ball to Williams. He didn't catch it. Then they threw the deep ball to Kirst. He did catch it. So the next week they come home to play for the second consecutive time, the San Francisco 49ers on Sunday Night Football, a game interrupted by lightning, but not interrupted by a San Francisco touchdown.
Oh, we knew what was up. It was a fun game and it was a huge game, but we were unconcerned with the Niners at that point.
What? Unconcerned with the Niners?
It was after what we'd done to the Niners the previous year, it was they're not coming into this house and winning. It's just not happening.
And now you're going to make me go dig up the audio of our preview for that game and see what you said about chances of victory. I guarantee you it wasn't 100%.
Wow, Russ was only 8 of 19. The defense destroyed them.
It was a 5-0 game at halftime. Then the Seahawks outscored the 49ers 24-3 in the second half.
Colin Kaepernick, 9 carries for 87 yards.
He always picked apart the Seahawks on the ground. That was also the year, that year, because the Packers, so he had had the game where he had the read option. In 2012, he had playoffs, he had had the read option and just destroyed the Packers. And they spent literally the entire preseason, offseason, preparing for the read option. And then Kaepernick came out and just threw the ball all over them the next year. It was one of the high points of Colin Kaepernick's career, I feel like.
This game, though, so there have been two times that I've evacuated seats because of lightning. This was the first time. The other time, obviously, was this last year on the UW game against Cal that went until 3 in the morning. Unfortunately, this lightning storm didn't last for that long.
Lasted the perfect amount of time because people got to watch the Breaking Bad Ozymandias episode. I'm probably blowing that pronunciation.
I was at the game, but did not get
to
watch that.
Not you, but people at home.
But we all walked out to it was just everybody evacuate to the corridor. We all went to the corridor as a night game. We were probably drinking pretty heavily. And we went, hung out for a little bit, and then went back to our seats and saw the Seahawks destroy the Niners.
It was a great time. The Seahawks followed that up with a 45-17 win over the Jacksonville Jaguars. Week 4, they head to Houston for a test against Matt Schaub and the Houston Texans at that point.
They should have lost this game, really.
They really should have. A game they were trailing 20-3 at halftime and 20-6 after three quarters. But Richard Sherman's 58-yard touchdown return off an interception off the Matt Schaub rollout on third down ties the game, and the Seahawks go on to win it in overtime.
Now, is this the week we recorded the first ever Pelton cast?
No, it was between week 1 and week 2.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? Huh. I had always thought it was right after that Texans game.
Nope. Yeah, it was a 3rd and 4. They decided to try and throw it. It did not go well. The Seahawks then suffered their first loss at Indianapolis, a game they led early.
And a game that I'm still upset about, that loss.
I mean, when is Russ going to get his chance to beat Andrew Luck?
God.
Then they ran off 7 consecutive wins midseason. A few highlights from that. The 14-9 Monday Night Football win at St. Louis, with a goal line stand on the final play in an 80-yard touchdown by Golden Tate. Then they come back from a 21-0 deficit versus the Mike Glennon-led Tampa Bay Buccaneers, the winless Mike Glennon-led Tampa Bay Buccaneers.
Was there a jump pass in that game, or is this a different one?
I don't remember a jump pass in that one. And then another highlight, the 34-7 Monday Night Football demolition of the New Orleans Saints.
And that was one of the biggest days in Seattle sports history, right?
Yes, that was the same day that Steve Sarkisian resigned as UW head coach to take the job at USC. And God, we will get to in a moment.
Such a good day.
It was a very good day.
Like, having that, and it seems like the Seahawks are always playing big Monday night games when important moments happen in Seattle sports, but having
that... We talked about it when Coach Pete stepped down. It was literally the exact same scenario. It was the same day.
Pretty crazy.
Also a Monday. Also, the Seahawks played on Monday Night Football.
Me and Chris Smith going to your house to record the Pelton cast, apparently on speakerphone. I think that was our first ever emergency pod, right?
No, well, it was our first emergency pod. So we'd done a post-game pod after the Monday Night Football St. Louis game.
Did we really? God, that game was terrible.
Yep. That's why we've forgotten that we did a podcast about it.
I mean, I remember sitting there and watching the game at your house, you and me and Chris Smith again, watching that game at your house and just being like, man, maybe this team isn't that good. Or being like, we know the defense is good, but maybe the team in general is not that good.
So the Seahawks' seven-game winning streak was snapped on December 8th when they went to San Francisco to face the 49ers. A big Kaepernick keeper on 3rd and 7. They essentially just ran a sweep with him.
God.
Set up Phil Dawson's winning field goal with 31 seconds left on that one.
Man, I'm still so frustrated about all of these losses.
I'm over them. The next week was kind of the debut of Nostra Tristan.
Really?
This clip.
How many interceptions do you think the Seahawks get this week?
I feel like two.
Four.
Four!
Four interceptions.
Wow!
Okay, so Eli did not throw four interceptions in that game. He threw five interceptions.
There we go.
The Seahawks won 23-0.
God, that game was so fun. When he kept throwing picks.
I vaguely recall, I did not go back to listen to the podcast about this. There was some like local car dealership that did a promotion based on Seahawks interceptions or Seahawks deep. If the Seahawks got a shutout in that game,
then they had to get their
their
chest tattooed. that game was so fun. I think we watched it at my old house. This was 2000. Yeah, we watched it at my old house, and just seeing Eli throw pick after pick after pick. And get so frustrated. Like, this defense was incredible.
Not good enough to prevent the Seahawks from their annual home loss to the Arizona Cardinals by a 17-10 final on December 22nd. At least they could not ruin Christmas Eve that year. Still, the Seahawks clinched the number one seed with a 27-9 win over St. Louis in the finale.
So that Cardinals game, did we drive up from Portland right beforehand? I'm pretty sure that's what happened.
That sounds plausible.
And then I think you dropped me off. I know you dropped me off at the stadium, and it's up there with, we've talked about this many times, one of the worst football games I've ever been to.
We were pretty concerned about the Seahawks offense at that point, and they didn't start well against St. Louis the next week. That game, it was 7-0 Seahawks on a Malcolm Smith interception return until deep into the second quarter. They did not score a touchdown until 2:21 left in the third, but the defense was still good enough that they were able to comfortably defeat the Rams.
When the defense, I haven't pulled up the old DVOA for this year, the defense was significantly better than the offense for the season, right?
I don't know if it was significantly better. It was probably better. The Seahawks were number one, of course, in defensive DVOA. They were seventh that year in offensive DVOA.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, that qualifies it significantly. Okay, so in the division round, the Seahawks hosted once again the New Orleans Saints, beat them 23-15 in a game that wasn't that close. They led 16-0 entering the fourth quarter and 23-8 with 2:40 left before a late touchdown by the Saints. That one was notable. Percy Harvin working back into the lineup. He'd missed much of nearly all of the regular season, really, due to injury. And scored a touchdown in this one, I believe.
Yeah, I remember so vividly the three losses that year. But this playoff game, it's kind of just gone.
I remember watching it.
So this was on a Sunday, right?
No, Saturday. Saturday
okay, this after. Was on a Saturday. Okay.
I remember the only options.
There was a night before this happened where I thought to myself, it was like the Friday night before this first playoff game. And I don't know why I had this thought. It was just, you know, sometimes you think outlandish things. And I was like, maybe I was sick or something. And I was like, I really hope that I don't die right now because I don't want to miss the Seahawks winning their first Super Bowl. And I remember laying there, like laying on our old leather kind of gross couches, being like, I'm going to die 3 weeks before the Seahawks win their first Super Bowl. And there was no lack of confidence that the Seahawks were going to win the Super Bowl. I knew that that was happening. I did not know that I wasn't going to die in those 3 weeks. I was much more unsure about.
Your chances of victory are way higher in hindsight. Although I guess every year you do boldly predict the Seahawks are going to win the Super Bowl and play the Steelers in the Thursday night opener. The Seahawks hosted the 49ers in the NFC Championship game. It was the only way. It had to happen, even though the 49ers were a wild card inevitably that year. After they played after the Broncos had beat the Patriots in the AFC Championship game earlier that afternoon. Seahawks trailed 10-3 at halftime and 17-13 entering the fourth quarter before shortly after the quarter break, Steven Hauschka tells Pete Carroll the field goal was too long for him. They come out for the fourth down and throw a touchdown pass to who else but Jermaine Kearse. You have no thoughts on that play?
It was great.
It was like an offside. Russ just throws it up and Kearse runs. What a great play. So everyone always forgets the wild sequence midway through the fourth quarter. Kearse fumbles at the one with the Seahawks trying to go up by 10 points at that point.
Uh-huh.
Or 11, I guess. Navarro Bowman forces the fumble but suffers a torn ACL and MCL on the play.
Yeah, a horrific injury.
Yeah, it really was never... Also, nothing was the same for Navarro Bowman, unfortunately. Marshawn Lynch recovers the fumble. Seahawks go for it on 4th-and-1. Russell Wilson sneaks and fumbles.
God. We didn't know yet. We didn't know. Yeah,
we probably should have known. Only for Cam Chancellor to pick off Kaepernick 2 plays later. The Seahawks added a Steven Hauschka field goal for a 23-17 lead, setting up the final drive all or nothing for the 49ers. They move the ball to 1st-and-10 at the Seahawks 18 with 30 seconds left. And that's when the tip happens. So
most important play in Seattle sports history.
Yeah, we've made that agreement previously.
I don't think really having that happen in front of us in the end zone right in front of where our seats are. Seeing the tip happen, and you're like, oh, that's a great tip. And then all of a sudden, Malcolm Smith is there to pick it off, and the game is over. Like, we're going to the Super Bowl. It is unlike any sport experience that I've ever had beforehand. Like, the elation that you have.
Unlike any post-game podcast we've ever had.
Are you running a clip from this?
I am.
Oh, God. And we've got a special guest with us here tonight. I might be slurring because we are in the alley between First Avenue and some train tracks after the Seahawks have advanced to the Super Bowl. And our special guest is...
Christopher Smith. And that thing is the Port of Seattle is what you were talking
Interesting.
About.
Interesting.
That is the Port of Seattle.
I might say some incorrect things. Well, I just slurred there. Incorrect things. I have been drinking since 11 a.m.
Oh, boy. So the Seahawks face the Broncos. It's a matchup of the number one defense versus the number one offense in the Super Bowl. And as much as you say you were 100% confident, you definitely were not anywhere near that in terms of chances of victory for the Super Bowl. Like, this was a legitimately scary game against Peyton Manning and the Broncos.
Oh, I mean, I thought it would come down to the Seahawks were up and the defense there was going to be a Manning drive. I mean,
yeah.
This game should have been, I mean, you look at this DVOA for the year, like the Seahawks were the best team in the league, but the Broncos weren't far off.
And that DVOA includes the Super Bowl, which swung things pretty considerably.
Yeah, the way that they manhandled the Broncos offense in this game, like, I think...
Well, you had a take on it at the time.
Oh, God.
So I think we buried the lead here, which is, we just won the Super Bowl. That happens.
Yes.
That's a thing.
This is real life right now.
It really is. If this is a dream, I haven't woken up from it yet.
Probably the greatest defensive performance in NFL history.
I mean, that's a bold claim, but when you talk about the arguably the number one offense of all time, holding it to 8 points, creating as many turnovers as the Seahawks defense did, scoring more points on defense than the Broncos scored on offense.
Yeah, there we go. I stand by it. I'm sure that there might have been better defensive performances, but this was the best offense by DVOA by a pretty significant margin.
It's one of the best of all time, and it started from the opening play with the Seahawks coming up with the safety, although that wasn't really anything they did. That was just Denver screw up. The Seahawks scored 36 points unanswered before the Broncos only score in the final play of the third quarter, and it was kind of close until Malcolm Smith's interception return for a touchdown with 3:21 left in the second, and then Percy Harvin returning the opening kick of the second half for a touchdown. The day after getting into a fist fight with, was it Doug or Golden Tate?
Golden Tate.
Yeah. That turned it into a rout. Jermaine Kearse added the touchdown because, of course, he did. He only scores touchdowns in the Super Bowl.
Because I predicted it in week.
In our 2014 preview. And Peyton Manning.
2014 preview? What?
Our year in review 2014 bold predictions.
No. We didn't do that. This was the first year of the Peltoncast.
Yeah, we did them in December
2013. Oh, I thought I predicted it when we chose to sponsor
Jermaine Kearse's football reference page?
Yeah.
I'll have to review the tapes here.
I'm pretty sure that we chose as the Peltoncast to sponsor Jermaine Kearse's, the only bit of advertising we've ever done is the Peltoncast. And
we screwed it up because we let it lapse. We weren't podcasting at the time. The Pro Football Reference stopped doing sponsorships. All the sports reference pages did. And the ones that are up there in perpetuity. We could have just been up there forever.
God, we could have been on the curse page forever.
Yeah.
Oh! Curse!
So then we go to the parade. It's very cold at the parade.
Don't forget. We already talked last week about listening to Kendrick after the game. But this was a Southside party unlike any other after the Super Bowl. We immediately had – we watched the game at Katie's in Fairwood, and there were quite a few of us there. We all sat around, recorded an emergency podcast, drinking Skittles-related cocktails because that was a thing you did in 2013. It was normal at the time. And then
it was the style of the time.
Immediately had to go seek out whatever party was happening in SeaTac, and I think it might have even been in Des Moines, and then we were taking hits off the half cheesy, a Southside shot, which is a pull straight from the half cheesy while listening to Money Trees by Kendrick Lamar. There could not be a more perfect day. That's it. One day.
Also, you had a child born in 2000. No, that was in 2000.
That was in 2012.
It was in 2014, the next one.
Yes. I know what their birthdays are. We didn't talk about it in the 2012 podcast.
We never did get around to Baby Fantasy Genius' arrival on the scene.
His birth. I was so hyped about the control verse coming, you know. The Seahawks pending Super Bowl, the control verse. who has time to talk about their first child being born?
Our 2013 was also a big year for UW football, which won its most games since 2000. They beat some coach named Chris Peterson and number 19 Boise State 38-6 in the second consecutive game between those two teams and the first at the renovated Husky Stadium.
I mean, you say that like we didn't, like Chris Peterson was an unknown coach.
I know, he was obviously a known commodity.
Okay, because we knew and liked Chris Peterson at the time.
Yeah, we just didn't know at the time that he was going to, within months, be the head coach.
Yes.
It was unclear at that point. You were very anti-Chris Peterson's coaching effort in that game.
It was bad. I mean, they coached a bad game, Boise State. And I'm sure there were times that it probably reflected his coaching at UW, but...
And Keith Price, 23-31, 324 yards in that one.
He knew he was coming here.
he barely didn't know that during the 2012 Las Vegas Bowl. Huskies then beat Illinois 34-24 in Chicago, beat Arizona in their Pac-12 opener to improve to 4-0 before losing back-to-back at number 5 Stanford, a 31-28 loss when a 4th-and-10 completion to Kevin Smith was overturned on replay by referee Land Clark.
Speaking of games that I'm still upset about, like I can put myself that exact moment sitting at Katie's. It was late. It was Pac-12 after dark. Fucking Land Clark. Like, I think Land Clark may have ended up being a fairly okay college referee, but like that he caught that ball.
And then they lost 45-24 versus Marcus Mariota in number 2 Oregon.
This was the game, the Stanford game. I'm not over that Stanford game. It was Ty Montgomery. We couldn't cover a kickoff. And Ty Montgomery kept taking those kickoffs. I mean, if you would have asked me in that moment who should be the number one pick in the draft, I was like, Ty Montgomery, easy. When the Seahawks didn't draft him, I was just like, huge mistake.
They drafted Tyler Lockett instead, right?
Did they really? They drafted Tyler Lockett the year after they won the Super Bowl? No.
No, you're right, because Kristen Michael was their first pick that year. Well, Ty Montgomery wasn't a senior. I think Ty Montgomery didn't come out for another year.
Oh, it was 2 years later. Okay. Yeah.
And little did we know that he was going to be a running back in the NFL.
They could not cover Ty Montgomery on these kickoffs, and they had no answer for it. That's why they lost that game. It was so unfair. Like, I don't think I've been more upset watching a football game. There have been a few Husky games, but this was one where it's like, we were a better team than Stanford that year and should have won that game.
I don't know if I would go that far. I think that was just a shitty game for Stanford. I think they were still a very good team.
If he makes that catch, we're winning the game too. I'm fully convinced if they call that a completion, we're winning that game.
They had moved the ball more on that drive than I thought they had. Yeah, they finished 11-3 that season and went to the Rose Bowl. So I don't know that I agree that the Seahawks were better.
Huskies?
The Huskies, yes. The Seahawks were better than Stanford. I will definitely say that. And it was a 45-24 loss versus Marcus Mariota and number 2 Oregon, who were headed to the championship game, followed by
That was game day. I mean, I feel like that's worth mentioning, that this was the first time...
I couldn't look that up.
This was the first time that college game day, you know, Husky Stadium had just reopened shortly thereafter, and there was a pretty big game between these two rivals. And the first time in our lives that game day had come to Seattle. So we did a breakfast tailgate.
I think it was the first time, yeah.
Well, and for a later game, I remember being there.
It's game day
really
existed
early.
Before our lifetimes.
And it poured rain. They got the full Seattle experience by doing game day that day. It poured rain the entire time. And we were undercover in Padelford. I remember, and I think we were eating breakfast foods, drinking mimosa, walking over to game day.
God, it was a great time.
Was it?
Until the game started. All right, that was followed by a 53-24 upset loss at Arizona State when Sark appeared affected by the heat on the sidelines.
God.
The Huskies bounced back with blowout wins at home over Cal and Colorado by a combined final of 100-24, then lost 41-31 at number 13 UCLA when Miles Jack scored 4 touchdowns.
That was a terrible game. Yeah. That was horrible.
That was the peak of Jim Elmora should be the next coach of the Huskies.
Oh, yeah.
Really, things went very off for Jim Elmora after that. With Keith Price injured, the Huskies won 69-27 at Oregon State behind 530 rushing yards and seven rushing TDs.
Did Schauch start that game?
No, Siler Miles.
Oh, Siler started.
Huskies led 48-0 at one point. Then they, with Price back, they beat Wazoo 27-17 in the Apple Cup 4 days before Sark announced his departure for USC.
Was this Bishop Sankey was the running back this year?
Yes.
I'm looking at highlights of the Stanford game. I want to see the – I'm trying to see the catch. There was some sort of horrible turnover that we had in the fourth quarter.
I don't specifically remember that, but
oh, Keith Price threw an interception at the goal line. I think it was Scove who picked it off. Is that right? No, that's not Shane Scove. That would have been much later.
AJ Tarpley had the interception for Stanford, but they had their leading tackler that day was
Kaysen
not Shane
on the sideline. God, Kaysen was good.
It was not Shane Scove. It was Patrick Scove.
Oh, Patrick Scove. Wait, is that his brother?
I think so.
Oh man, Jadon Mickens touchdown. Is this I need to watch until I see this. Okay, Price is rolling out. He's pointing down the field. He throws it. That's a catch. Are you kidding me? That is a catch. Oh my god. Did they review it? Did they review that play and still call it an incomplete pass? This is a this is a Stanford focused broadcast.
I thought it was overturned on replay from what I read.
Oh, they called it a catch on the field and then overturned it. The way that they're showing it, there's in this clip, it's like extremely hard to see, but it looks like a catch to me, obviously, because it's haunted me for now 7 years.
Don't expect you to see anything else. So 4 days after that, on a Friday morning, the Huskies announced Coach Pete as their new head coach. Here's a clip of that podcast recorded via Skype.
Hello and welcome to a special Chris Peterson edition of the Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
I'm Tristan Carcina.
And we have a new head coach of the Washington Huskies.
Could not be more excited. Well, I probably could be more excited. But Chris Peterson signing on with the Huskies this morning, it was great news. I went to sleep last night. This is actually kind of similar to your Coach Sark leaving story. I went to sleep last night and it was very late. And it seemed like a pretty big limbo for Chris Peterson. There were a lot of reports coming out of Idaho that he was not going to take the job. And then I woke up very early this morning at about 7 a.m. Chris Peterson is the head coach at UW.
So obviously that worked out pretty well.
Uh-huh. Yep. And the Mariners...
worked out equally well.
Yeah, with Robinson Cano. Made every dollar back in that Robinson Cano deal.
The Mets ended up paying a lot of it. Before Coach Pete made his debut on the sidelines, Marcus Tuiasosopo coached the Huskies in the Fight Hunger Bowl as they beat BYU 31-16 with Taysom Hill at quarterback for BYU.
Wow.
25-48 for 293 yards with 31 carries for 133 yards.
Pay that man.
It was not as good a season for UW men's basketball, which began their downward trend in the late Lorenzo Romar era. The Huskies lost both Terrence Ross and Tony Roten to the first round of the NBA draft. We've been talking about Roten a lot, but like last week, but not about Terrence Ross at all, who was the lottery pick and was like the much better of those two players.
Oh, love Terrence Ross too.
The Huskies lost their second game at home to Albany, 63-62. That was the first sign something was amiss. Then lost at home to both Colorado State and Nevada. They actually started Pac-12 play 4-0, but then lost 7 of their next 8 before rallying to finish 9-9 in conference play. They were still sort of on the bubble after beating Wazoo 64-62 in the Pac-12 tournament opener, but lost 80-77 to Oregon in overtime to get knocked off it. And then in the NIT, played their opening game at BYU, losing 90-79.
Who was on this team? Who were the stars of this team?
Well, CJ Wilcox was the star of this team. There's a lot of solid players. Abdul Gaddy, Scott Suggs, Aziz Anjai were all seniors. And then you had some, you know, the young guys were not really ready to contribute yet in terms of Desmond Simmons. Andrew Andrews was just a redshirt freshman, Sean Kemp Jr.
But this was the time period where the Huskies losing a couple of basically full classes, partially just because they were too good, really hurt them, right? Because Adrian Oliver would have been on this team, right?
No, I don't think so. I mean,
he would have been gone by that point.
He was like 2009 was would okay. have been his senior year.
Okay, well, never mind.
It was more that like Ross went out earlier than expected, that sort of thing. Like, I don't think they recruited him thinking he was going to be a 2-year guy. The Sounders reached the semifinals of the CONCACAF Champions League in 2013. They beat Tigres UANL 3-2 on aggregate in the quarterfinals to set up a matchup with Santos Laguna, losing 2-1 on aggregate to the Liga MX side. Still the deepest CCL run for the Sounders. However, their U.S. Open Cup final streak came to a shocking ending with a 1-0 defeat in the third round at the USL Tampa Bay Rowdies.
Wow.
The Sounders started MLS play 0-3-2 but won 4 of their next 5 matches, and then after days of rumors, introduced Clint Dempsey as their new designated player on August 3rd in the midst of a stretch of 8 wins and 9 matches from July 28th through September 13th. I can still remember where I was when this Dempsey news came down. I was at Seafair.
Really? I can remember where I was.
Walking back
I
from the time trials.
This is not to be discussed on a podcast, but it was a very bad day for me.
Okay. The Sounders stumbled down the stretch with a 4-game losing streak in October, finishing 4th in the West. They beat the Colorado Rapids 2-0 in the knockout round at home before losing 5-3 on aggregate to the rival Portland Timbers in the quarterfinals. The Seattle Storm played the season without both Sue Bird and Lauren Jackson. LJ's career was over, though she didn't know it yet. She just decided to take the 2013 season off after hamstring surgery. Meanwhile, Bird underwent season-ending surgery in the spring to remove a cyst from her right knee. So the expectations were pretty low for the Storm coming off a sub-500 season, but they actually improved to 17-17 with Tina Thompson playing the final season of her legendary WNBA career as the team's leading scorer. All 5 regular starters averaged double figures as the Storm extended their playoff streak to 10 seasons, but they were swept in the first round by the Lynx with Game 2 at the Tacoma Dome because Kiarita in Seattle Center had bet the Storm wouldn't make the playoffs, and I'm pretty sure it was Microsoft is holding a convention there. The Seattle Mariners suffered their 4th consecutive losing season despite a strong 1-2 starting punch of Felix Hernandez and Hisashi Iwakuma, who was an all-star after going 14-6 with a 2.66 ERA, but no other rotation starter had an ERA below 4.98, and the offense was typically bad before they added Robinson Cano after the season. The Blazers started a new era in sort of slow fashion. Damian Lillard, having been drafted the previous summer with that pick they got at the deadline for Gerald Wallace, won Rookie of the Year, averaging 19 points and 6.5 assists per game. But a weak bench and porous defense, the Blazers were 26th in defensive rating, cost them in Terry Stotts' first season in Portland. The Blazers really shut it down after being eliminated from playoff consideration, losing their final 13 games, 6 of which I attended, including Kobe Bryant's 47-point game, the game before his Achilles tear that he had in Portland on my birthday.
Losing those games meant that they were able to get, maybe this is what you're alluding to, meant that they were able to get the draft pick that really carried them through the next 7 years or so.
With CJ McCollum?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they were still 10th. It wasn't like they tanked their way all up to, like, you know, the top 3 or something, but it did work out well for them.
Well, I mean, obviously, Dame is the one who's carried them through this time period, but, like, right. Having
but
both
been very
Dame
good.
And CJ together means that, you know, it took a little bit of pressure off Dame. The defenses haven't been able to lock in on him as much as they would otherwise if he didn't have the kind of support.
And think if they would have drafted 14th, they would have been stuck with Giannis. I'm just saying I don't know that we can point to that losing streak and be like, that saved the team. The Blazers had beaten the Lakers on Halloween in their home opener, the second game for the This Is Going to Be Fun Lakers, when Steve Nash suffered a tibial injury that really basically ended his productive and healthy career, sadly.
That was the Dwight Howard, Steve Nash, Kobe Lakers?
Yes, it was.
That was going to be fun?
It's the SI cover.
Oh, my God.
We all thought so. I think I'm pretty sure I picked them to win the championship.
Did they make the playoffs?
They did. They were swept by the Spurs.
It definitely reeks of, like, when just any time that there's these quote-unquote super teams that get together, when the Eagles had that super team, right?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
All right, should we talk about the year in music? Because it was a year.
It really was. Man, I keep thinking as we get later on in these years from like, oh, this will be the point that this stuff feels too new to reminisce about. And that's not the case with 2013. I mean, a lot of artists who now are basically the biggest artists on earth were putting out music in 2013 or starting in 2013 in a lot of ways. The most important.
Yeah, it's just a really interesting moment, it felt like, where you've got this new generation coming up, but, you know. I mean, not that Magna Carta Holy Grail was, but the older generation is.
Did this
still
there. Did that come out in 2013?
It sure did.
We need to talk about that, but
do we?
Yes, we do. The moment that I remember, though, from 2013, the most musically, there are quite a few. It was Saturday night, and the song "Get Lucky" by Daft Punk was released on. I think it was even just like a little snippet of it. I don't even think it was the full song, and it was a Saturday night, and I sat and listened to that song for literally 3 straight hours. I remember I was doing Pilates on my floor. I think they premiered it during an episode of SNL, and like
correct.
It played through there, and it immediately was on YouTube, and people had looped it so it would play for however many hours, and I listened
wait,
to
wait, what did you say you were doing?
I did Pilates. I'm telling you, this is a distinct memory I have, being on my floor, doing Pilates, and listening to Get Lucky over and over and over and over again. I heard day 100 times.
I heard some version that was not right, and you were like, have you heard this? It was the most amazing thing, and I'm like, it feels like it keeps building to something, but it never gets there. And then at some point shortly thereafter, I heard the correct version. I was like, oh, I get what you're talking about. This is amazing. We talked last week about how, you know, there was an album that I would listen to on repeat when I was writing that year's, in this case, player profiles. It was no longer a book specifically. And Random Access Memories was 100% that album in the summer of 2013.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Daft Punk was a big group before then. I had an intern previously who basically paid no attention to electronic music and went to a Daft Punk show that was in Seattle in like, I don't know, 2009 or something. And he is like, he probably still is like a house DJ. It was like Daft Punk was a life-changing group at the time. But 2013 was the year that they became Jan knows who Daft Punk is. You know, this was when Daft Punk went from being like kind of weird electronic group to being one of the biggest groups in the entire world.
Yep.
And it was all thanks to one giant hat from Pharrell.
I mean, what a year for Pharrell. Well, he's all in. I mean, should we get into this?
I feel like the next year is really the Pharrell moment, but this was, Pharrell was everywhere.
I mean, it was the next year was the Pharrell solo moment.
Yes.
But Pharrell was on all of these big songs in 2013. Get Lucky, Fed's Watching, and then, of course, the other song of the summer besides Get Lucky, which is not aged in quite the same way, Blurred Lines.
Some of us didn't like it at the time, for the record. I actually remember I used to listen to sports radio, and hate to out myself. I remember Elise Woodward was on sport whatever. I was like driving to work one day and I dropped off Baby Fantasy Genius and Elise Woodward was talking and she was talking to people and she was like, have you heard that song by Robin Thicke? I was like, Alan Thicke's kid? That guy? Because
hadn't he already done the ads with Paula Patton? What was it? For some alcohol, right?
He used to go by Thicke. That's how I knew Robin. When I first heard of Robin Thicke, and
that sounds yeah, that's right.
And it was just like he was like a weirdo Canadian pop star who happened to be Alan Thicke's kid, and like that's basically how we knew him. And I was like, we used to make fun of him when I was in high school, in my more hipster circles. Then Elise Woodward was talking.
Remy Martin ad. They used to play that like during every NBA game. Although that might, yeah, no, that was in 2012. So that was before this.
And then this fucking song came out, and immediately I was like, first off, it's bad. Second off, I mean, culturally, where I was at the Vera Project was where the rest of the world is in 2020. You know, like, the world has changed in that decade, but the people that I was around all hated the song immediately and understood that it's, you know, it's basically like
problematic feels like it's selling it short.
Sure. That's probably yes. We'll stay there. That it was problematic, right? And it's not the type of song that it was not going to age well.
And it didn't. Put some other stuff from 2013.
Yeah. So, but Elise Woodward that day fucking loved it. I remember her talking and it's like, okay.
So, many people did, to be clear.
That's where I heard of the song. This is not to out Elise Woodward or whatever is liking Blurred Lines, but she just, that was the first time that I ever heard it, was her talking about it. Also in 2013, we have probably what I consider to be the last great Kanye album in Yeezus. This was another one where it was like...
You don't think The Life of Pablo? I mean, The Life of Pablo is inconsistent, but it's definitely got some great high points.
But this is the last great Kanye West album.
Okay.
Yeezus was the moment where I was just like, oh, Kanye West can do whatever the fuck he wants. And there were stories that like... Rick Rubin showed up 2 weeks before it was supposed to be released or needed to be like turned into the label, and Kanye had basically nothing done, and he just like off the cuff recorded every lyric to the album, sort of apocryphal stories about it, but it was like almost all of it is amazing. I think it was New Slaves, where that summer every single movie trailer, it was either Macklemore or it was New Slaves, and that was it. It's like you couldn't release a movie. Michael Bay couldn't go anywhere without a film trailer having one of those two songs. But Blood on the Leaves is like, if we're ranking Kanye songs, it is high, high up there. And it was like Kanye, he went from Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, which is a well thought out masterpiece. It was pored over. He'd spent time on it. And then watch The Throne, which is like a little bit more off the cuff, to being like, this is Kanye at his most immediate. This is a rap album. This is Kanye talking about real shit, not worried about the 30 seconds of musical arrangement or whatever, right? He wanted it to hit you in a way that it absolutely did with Yeezus. And I think it was a surprise release that came out. And it was like, it wasn't the three singles and then a record. This was just like, here's Yeezus.
There it was.
I'm going to listen to it tonight. I miss this era of Kanye.
I wish we all missed this era of Kanye. Almost any other era of Kanye, although I mean, the last couple of weeks have been better, perhaps.
We'll talk about Life of Pablo when we get there, but...
Are we going to get there?
Yeah.
What's our plan here?
Yeah, we're going to get there.
Okay.
We're remembering every year. We'll remember 2020. Shit, it's been a weird year. remember January?
barely. Should we talk about Kendrick?
I don't think I was on Twitter in 2013. I don't know where I was hearing about this, but like the second that Control happened, it was all anybody was talking about in the like rap internet world. It was like, what just happened?
I remember my timeline just being all tweets about Control.
It was incredible. I mean, like I'm still, I'll listen to it and be like, God damn, Kendrick. When he's like, I'm the king of New York as a rapper from Compton, that is some real shit. even in, you know, the climate had changed since the 90s, but, like, that is Kendrick Lamar being like, nobody can fuck with me. And sometimes it's fun having the best rapper alive being like, I'm the best rapper alive, and I'm going to call out by name other artists who I'm competing with but are not as good as me. You know, like, it harkens back to the sort of, like, old-school hip-hop mentality of, like, the battle raps or whatever that I feel like by this time in 2013 wasn't really a thing, you know? Like, you talk about just artists would collaborate with each other. There wasn't the animosity that happened earlier on, for better, right? But having a moment where you have literally, indisputably, the best rapper alive, maybe still to this day, telling every individual one of their peers that they're trying to destroy them, is just like, it sounds great. I wish it happened more often.
I don't feel like this has had the shelf life necessarily you would have expected based on how big it was in the moment.
It's not anywhere. You have to go to YouTube to find it. Like, that actually increases the mystique of it, though. This was in Shay's rap yearbook, right? Because I know him by name, of course, by first name, of course.
You should, yes.
In the rap yearbook, Control was the song of the year for 2013.
Sounds right.
Right? Like, it doesn't have the shelf life because it wasn't a radio single. It wasn't, it's like, that actually makes it more impressive that he had the rap yearbook song of the year, and this was never serviced to radio. This has not been on DSPs. Like, you have to go to YouTube, and I don't care about, I don't even know the Big Sean part of the song. For all intents and purposes, it is a Kendrick Lamar song. Like, there's one verse that matters on Control, and it is Kendrick Lamar's verse. I don't think I've ever even listened to the entire song. I listened to it this weekend. I've been listening to a lot of Kendrick lately since we talked about him last week. And it was like, I went to YouTube and I listened to this. I listened to the original I that was not on To Pimp a Butterfly. And it was like, they sounded incredible.
I want to shout out. This actually didn't technically make, because I couldn't clear it, the Hall of Fame album by Big Sean. But the song Beware, definitely a favorite of mine from there, with Lil Wayne and Jhené Aiko. Should we talk about Nothing Was the Same?
Oh, man. Nothing was the same. to me, this was the moment that Drake really became
president.
Yes! It is true. Of Canada, of course.
I guess, yeah. Prime Minister, I guess. I don't know.
Drake became the biggest radio artist. He was the biggest rapper in the world. Kendrick Lamar is the best rapper in the world. Drake became the biggest rapper in the world.
I did not remember until I went to go listen to our 2013 music review, where we reviewed the Pitchfork Top 10, and we'll talk about that in a second. Hold On, We're Going Home, number one on that list.
And, I mean,
deservedly so.
Oh, yeah. He made the perfect pop song. Like, he really, I guess, that's the thing. He was the biggest rapper alive, but Hold On, We're Going Home is not a rap song.
Although, funny enough, that was not the song from that album that ended up making my top five songs of the 2010s.
What was the one that made it?
It was The Motion, reissued with Care Package, which you called your least favorite song on that album.
At the time?
Yeah, in 2013.
Really?
Drake and Sampha.
I called it my least favorite song?
Yeah, on that album. Not of all time. You probably still liked it better than Blurred Lines.
Yeah. All Me, though, 2 Chainz and Big Sean, started from the bottom and now we're here. Like, yeah, 305 to My City. There's so much on this. That's why I could beat Serena when she's playing with her left. Like, it's the only Drake album that I've really cared about. You know, I've cared about singles or whatever, but like,
you cared about photoshopping yourself into the Views cover.
Oh, yeah. We all were at the time.
This was the style of the time.
But But as far as like a full album, it was like, oh, this is Drake's cool.
Do you have any thoughts on Because of the Internet?
I was late to Because of the Internet. I think I mentioned this when we talked about Gambino a couple weeks ago, but it was like after, and this might have been even after, oh my God, a big R&B album that he put out, the next one that made him famous.
Kawhi was the next one, wasn't it?
Kawhi?
Yeah.
No. Me and
for
your mama.
Gambino?
Redbone? God.
That was A Week in My Love.
Yes.
That wasn't until 2016, though.
Okay.
That wasn't the next album.
I never once listened to Kawhi. That's like, it wasn't until Awaken My Love that I went back and listened to Because of the Internet. Because I'd felt so negative. And that was when I like went through and like watched the video for Sober and watched the video for 3005. And I was like, oh, actually, these are really good. I was like, oh, I actually made a mistake by not being into this way earlier.
So this was an era, 2013, when you knew when everything was going to come out still. There weren't these surprise drops.
There definitely were. Okay. I disagree with that.
And that all changed in December when Beyonce came out of nowhere with her self-titled album.
Sorry, I'm busy disputing that there weren't self-titled drops because Yeezus definitely came out like... Well, the promotion and release section of Wikipedia is way longer than I want it to be for Yeezus.
On May 1st, West used Twitter to post a single message reading June 18th, leading several media outlets to speculate that the post referred to the release date of West's upcoming album. On May 17th, he began promotion of the album. This does not sound...
No,
just dropped
it,
out of
it
nowhere.
It wasn't as surprise as the Beyonce.
Like people,
Beyonce
people
just
thought
like
that
was... only surprise releases music.
Yes, that's true.
The Yeezus tour, when did that happen in 2013?
Yes.
Okay, so me...
It was after the Arizona State game. I'm pretty sure that I was babysitting Fantasy Genius during well, you guys were at that show, which went so fucking late.
Me and Mrs. Fantasy Genius, we got there. Chris was there. I think Chris and Jason. We went and met them at Mod Pizza and hung out at Mod Pizza. And then it was like, okay, we got to get into the arena. It was at Key Arena. And this was the one where Kanye had like a big mountain where people would come down from. I think he wore the mask the entire time. He had like metal mask that he wore. Kendrick actually opened the show. Which if you want to, like, Jesus Christ, thinking about that tour.
That is pretty wild.
Kendrick opened the show. So this is the second time that I'd seen Kendrick. Kendrick was a big deal, but he wasn't like... Kanye was so important in 2013 that it was like Kendrick is like a cool emerging artist and it's cool that he's playing these shows, but we just cared so much about Kanye. And then
fun fact, that was the opening show of the tour.
Well, yes, because his tour bus was stolen, I believe, beforehand, and that's why he ended up being so late to the show. But it was just like waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. He probably went on at like 11 o'clock. Tons of people had left Key Arena. And Mrs. Fantasy Genius is like, I'm ready to go home. We need to go see our fairly young child. right? He was 5 months old if this was November.
No, he was a year and 5 months.
A year and 5 months old. Okay, so he wasn't that young. And she was just like, I need to go home. And I was like, we're not leaving. I was like, we're not leaving until Kanye is done. And then he played forever. It was like Kanye went on for at least 2 full hours.
It started with
a
giant effigy.
Gillian says it started with a giant effigy. There was like a procession of his backup singers walking down from the mountain. I wish I could go back to this moment right now. Honestly, if any moment of 2013, I would go here over the Super Bowl. Because seeing Kanye and
well, that... Technically, the Super Bowl was 2014, so...
All right, good. I'll go back in time to that for 2014. I'm going back to the day of the Yeezus show.
Maybe your Fantasy Genius's birth. Tough break.
Yeah, sorry.
I mean, Kirk Cousins threw a lot of interceptions for your fantasy team that night.
Oh, yeah. Should have never started him. I was ahead of the game starting in, though. That Yeezus tour, though, like, I mean, I've seen Kanye since then a couple of times, and this was, it might not have been the peak Kanye show.
No.
Okay, wow, Kaylin is really mad about this. What's your peak Kanye show?
Anything else?
Which one? Watch the Throne? Do you remember that?
It was fine.
That was not fine.
It was fine.
We had to go to Tacoma.
Yeah, it was fine.
It's not Kanye's fault.
At Bumbershoot? I think the best was on the Glow in the Dark tour when he had, you weren't there with us. The Glow in the Dark tour, this was the Stunner Shades Kanye, and he had like a spaceship come out and this planet behind him.
Yeah, I did. I remember that.
No, I'm talking about Al wasn't there.
Yeah, that was
fun. At Key Arena. That one was pretty incredible.
So that, Glow in the Dark tour. Yeah, yes. That's much too early. There was another Kanye in like 2016 that I had tickets to, but then I ended up in Bristol during.
Oh yeah, no, that's the Life of Pablo tour where he had the big floating stage the night that there was I think the second or third presidential debate that night. Energy was weird.
That sounds weird.
Yeah. There was a presidential debate. Kanye, actually, I think, was tuning in and heard some things he loved. he was making some decisions that night.
We're not going to get into it right now.
But no, the Yeezus, end of the Yeezus tour, I'm telling you, this was Kanye at his peak. He was just starting to, like, go off the edge a little bit. And it was like, it was still perfect in that moment.
Okay, you wanted to talk about Magna Carta Holy Grail?
So I think, if I recall correctly, this was the one that was available to T-Mobile users at first, right? And I think it came out on the 4th of July. Am I right about this?
Plausibly? Yes, it did come out on the 4th of July.
And it was horrible.
It's not great.
This actually wasn't the one. I'm thinking of a different. It's still that... Oh, God, that Beach Chair album, which I can't ever remember what it's called.
Beach Chair
album? Yeah, his comeback, the Show Me What You Got record. There's so many times that I'm sure the listener at home is just like so frustrated because I can't remember things. I distinctly remember, I think this happened after this one too. I might have just been looking to fight. Oh, I'm looking at what that stupid record is called. Before Blueprint 3. Oh, yeah, American Gangster was good.
Kingdom Come?
Kingdom Come. Oh, God, it's terrible. Wow, that was 2006. I distinctly remember fighting with Katie about it, though. Because Katie loves fighting. And she always, if there's, like, an opinion of an artist that she likes and they do something bad, I'm at the front of the boat to be like, this is bad. You know? I refuse to. I've been around people who are like, I will like whatever artist no matter what they do. They'll like Paul Westerberg no matter what he puts out, no matter how many years it's been since he's released relevant music. I'm not in that boat. Like, if Jay-Z puts out a bad album, I'm not interested. Kanye's most recent music, literally never heard it. Right? It's like, they're artists that I love, but I don't want to hear when they're doing stuff that isn't good. And Katie will always be like, oh, this is good. And then in those moments, I'm like, tell me that you care about these songs. I'll be like, Katie, can you name a song from Magna Carta Holy Grail today? You know, like, can you tell me that you actually care about any music on Kingdom Come in 2020?
I can name Magna Carta.
And then Holy Grail. I think there actually were maybe some successful singles from it. But, like, not interested. Especially
Tom Ford was moderately successful.
Yeah,
it definitely
Ford.
Was not that successful of an album.
That was just for Katie, though. Katie will always defend, especially because if somebody else is like, this is bad, that immediately raises Katie's, like...
When you say somebody else, you mean you or me. Okay. Let's go through the top 10, Pitchfork top 10 of 2013 that we talked about on the podcast, because I want to go through this. Number 10 is Play by Play by Autry Nouveau.
Wow.
Number 9 was Dream House by Def Heaven.
Wow.
Number 8 was Get Lucky. Number 7, Latch by Disclosure featuring Sam Smith. Number 6, The Wire by Haim. Number 5, the entire reason you wanted me to talk about the Pitchfork Top 10.
Body Party.
By Sierra. The number 1 all-time song of Third Belton Brother, Natalie Wyatt.
Really?
And it yielded this clip.
Okay, next we have Ciara with Body Party.
And why did you want me to talk about this?
I just wanted to hear you talking about how sexy this song is.
I mean, you can't really say anything else about this song. I mean, it clearly is. It's undeniable.
It clearly is what?
It's undeniably sexy.
Oh, that's what I wanted to hear.
So there you go. At that point, Ciara was just like, hey, famous singer, Ciara.
Yep.
We didn't have the personal... She was not the first lady of the Seahawks.
Pretty incredible.
Is Russell Wilson's wife. So, a lot has changed in the last 7 years.
Yes, as it always does. I mean, but also, I mean, beyond that this year, like, Modern Vampires of the City, I think one of my top...
We're going to finish going through the top ten.
You have more, okay.
Number 4 was Reflector by Arcade Fire. That's one of the albums we haven't talked
really
about so far.
That really was number 4 on the Pitchfork Top Songs. Wow.
I was pretty shocked. It's not even my favorite song off that album. Number 3, Hannah Hunt by Vampire Weekend.
Yep.
Modern Vampires of the City. Number 2 was New Slaves. And number 1, Hold On, We're Going Home.
But just in general, the year, I'm really shocked about Reflector. I don't remember that being actually that well received. This was... the end of Arcade Fire being at least it's been 7 years, so I suppose I can't really keep it that open, but like this is the end of them being like the critical indie darlings. Vampire Weekend probably also in some capacity, but I mean talking about like having
Vampire Weekend, their most recent album was pretty well received, wasn't it?
not in the way that
no
I mean, this was the...
But also, it was indie rock, is it the same thing it was in 2013?
It was also on a major label. We've talked about the beginning of indie rock being a big genre, and I think 2013 might be the last year that it held on.
I mean, you do have, in addition to what we've talked about, an album by The National that was pretty big... But yeah, this is the Arctic Monkeys, but it's definitely the tail end.
I think this is maybe the last year of the golden age of indie rock. And it's like the artists who were indie artists, you know, artists like Haim, right? Like all of a sudden they're releasing music on major labels, you know?
Yeah.
And it's becoming, it just has gotten like a little bit bigger. So... I think that, you know, and you have, like, Arctic Monkeys being a major label release. Like, this is... I'm not saying that this is the end of rock music, but clearly, you know, you had Disclosure in the top 10, right? And it's like, that is the direction that sort of non-hip-hop music is going. And,
yes.
And it's not indie rock. It's definitely moving electronic music. So Lord also...
Yeah.
I remember hearing Royals. I think this was on Kiss 106. And my friend was with me in the car. And she was like, oh, Lord, this person's going to be playing at Decibel Festival, which was an electronic festival that happened in Seattle for a couple years in the around the early 2010s, which seemed like a crazy thing at the time. She was like, oh, yeah, it's this like 16-year-old from New Zealand who's doing really well. And the speed that Lord took off with as a major artist was pretty incredible.
It was, yes.
And I think I'm a noted Lord follow-up record hater, but Pure Heroin, pretty solid top to bottom. And as far as like radio pop music, definitely paved the way for artists like Billie Eilish that are doing very interesting radio pop music.
Yeah. You also have Ariana Grande's first album with Yours Truly.
I'm pretty sure that's probably a Drake album.
Drake also released an album called Doris, like your old sweatshirt, but it's all about Doris Burke.
Nah.
Yeah, there's just a lot going on musically in 2013.
No, this was a big year. I mean, for us to start the podcast, like that Pitchfork top 10 really kind of covers the gamut. Entre Nouveau lost to the Sands of Time, sadly.
Yeah. Yeah, I had forgotten that one.
I had one very fun night watching them at South by Southwest.
I would say if we're ready to transition, it was a much bigger year for music 2013 than it was for TV.
Yeah, kind of crazy how bad of it. This was, I guess we were in the golden age of television, but there was maybe an in-between where there was like, there was the golden age of television that happened on cable TV.
Yeah.
But it was before it happened on streaming services, before Netflix. I mean, so you have...
Well, this was... I mean, Orange is the New Black debuts in 2013. So, like, Netflix is starting to create a new series, but it's not really a big force yet.
Yeah, so this is definitely paving the way for... This is the first year that I think we really understood... It was probably the first year where I had Netflix as a streaming app rather than getting discs from them. I'm sure I was still getting discs from Netflix in 2013, but... I think I probably started focusing on the streaming aspect of it a little bit more around this time period. And like, I remember watching House of Cards on Netflix, and I remember watching the first season of Orange is the New Black, but it definitely was like, this is where things are changing. You know, everybody has access to relatively high speed internet. People are starting to have it on their phones really often. And so it's making it quite a bit easier to have these shows become major, major shows. You know, the iPad had been around. Like, most people have access to stream something somewhere, right? They're not watching TV explicitly on their television by 2013. And I think that's what really gives way to the rise of places like Netflix as powerhouses in the TV world.
On the network front, we had Brooklyn Nine-Nine debuting, a series that has been one of my favorites because it's, you know, thoughtful and sweet, even though it deals, you know, with difficult topics. I'm not sure what the place is for Brooklyn Nine-Nine in a modern world that is
rapidly
changing our relationship. Did it?
No. Cops got canceled today.
Cops, yes, did get canceled. I mean, like, Brooklyn Nine-Nine has taken on the issue of racial profiling. You know, it's not something that it's steered away from. I'm just not sure how you handle it now.
No, is it still on the air?
It would just air it in the spring.
There cannot be another season of Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
It will be interesting to see what they do. All right, movies in 2013.
You don't want to talk about the 206?
Yeah, the 206, which was the successor. I guess there was the John Report with Bob as the actual successor,
yes,
to Almost Live.
So there's no Pat
206,
Cashman,
the new,
right,
generation.
On the John Report with Bob?
I do not think he was a part of that one. This was originally the 206 was John Keister and Pat Cashman and then Chris Cashman.
Okay. You know, there have been a lot of times since Almost Live aired that they've tried to figure out, King 5 has tried to figure out a replacement for Almost Live, and it just has never worked. You know, there's something magical about Almost Live itself and the cast. And
the time in Seattle.
Yeah.
When you had such recognizable, distinct, like, tropes about areas of the city.
Yeah, and it just hasn't worked with these skeleton crews that they've tried to do it with after. You know, like, but Almost Live at the time was developing a lot of national talent from Seattle and comedy. And it's sad that it has gone away and there hasn't been any sort of replacement. Not that most cities have a local sketch comedy show.
Right. It was unusual.
It's a pretty unique thing, but it also is awesome that we got to grow up in a time period where there was Almost Live, because it's something that to generations after us is going to seem very strange.
Yes.
There was a show that actually pushed Saturday Night Live back a half an hour in this one random city and developed this talent that went on to be part of, you know, major, major TV shows after that.
the future generations are also going to be really shocked when we tell them that Monday Night Football was tape delayed here so that we could have the local news.
Wait, really? In Seattle?
Yeah.
When?
Throughout the 90s.
Really?
I don't know exactly when that ended, but for a long period of time.
Wow.
The show that you've seen the most that debuted in 2013, of course, was Paw Patrol.
Is that the show I've seen the most?
I think so.
I'm a little surprised that it debuted only in 2013. I feel like it's been around forever. Paw Patrol is with us in our souls, including there's a Harlan Williams TV show called Puppy Dog Pals. You remember Harlan?
No.
Is that his name?
Oh, I mean, yes. I mean, yes, I do remember Harlan.
He has a.
I don't remember the show.
He has, well, yeah, it's a children's show. It'd be weird if you knew it.
I know Paw Patrol. I know a lot about Paw Patrol.
Do you?
I know Marshall.
It's funny because I've seen a lot of people talk about the dad parts of the internet, talk about the Octonauts quite a bit, which is like, if you want to talk about shows that I've seen the most of. Wow. Harlan Williams is cousin to a member of the Bare Naked Ladies because all Canadians are related to each other.
That checks out. Monday Night Football was tape delayed from 1970 through 1995 in Seattle and Portland.
Wow. 25 years. They should have just invented the internet because they would have known what was going on.
I mean, the internet did end it, I assume. Shouts to Starwave.
Yeah, Puppy Dog Pals is a direct ripoff of Paw Patrol and is written, I believe, and directed by Harlan Williams. So there you go. Well,
there you go. On the movie front, Anchorman 2, The Legend Continues, which... It got shockingly good reviews when I looked at its Wikipedia
really?
Page.
Wow, I remember that movie being terrible.
Yeah, we went to go see it in the theaters like right after it opened and have not really thought about Anchorman 2 ever since.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Anything else you want to touch on in 2013 film?
I don't know. I mean, Wolf of Wall Street was... a very fun film. This was, we're nearing the McConaughey moment, right? Like
this is the McConaissance. Yeah. Dallas Buyers Club came out in
2013. Okay. So
I mean, first off, the McConaissance really started with Magic Mike, but.
I think there was a moment, we might still be in this moment. No, we're not. There was a moment where Matthew McConaughey was the coolest person on earth. He was both the best actor on earth and the coolest person on earth. Because you. He just.
Surprisingly, his Wikipedia does not refer to the McConaissance.
Wow.
Wait, Matthew McConaughey was in Angels in the Outfield? I didn't remember that.
Really? I saw Matthew McConaughey the other day driving up and delivering stuff to, like, medical supplies somewhere in Texas. And I was just like, God, Matthew McConaughey. Everything you do is cool. Still to this day.
He played an outfielder for the Angels.
Really?
Yeah.
But his moment in The Wolf of Wall Street is like... I mean, he's in the movie for 5 minutes total, and it's just like... He's the best part of the movie.
Angels in the Outfield has a shockingly strong cast. Adrian Brody played one of the Angels players. Dermot Mulroney was in a bit part. Really going deep.
Uh-huh. Denzel was one of the Angels. But that 2013 from McConaughey, I mean, he did two films. One he won, I believe, Best Actor for Dallas Buyers Club. And then also Wolf of Wall Street, like, that is a 2013, if you're going to do one.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. All right, anything else on 2013?
Oh, man. Great year. Last great year, honestly, if we're being honest here.
I mean, 2014 was actually when the Seahawks won the Super Bowl. It was a pretty good year. We've got some questions about the 2014 season, the end of the 2014 season, but the year 2014 was pretty good.
Yeah, 2014, if I'm going back in time, I'm going back. That's a new segment. I'm going back in time in 2013 to the Colonier Show. I'm going back in time in 2014 to the Super Bowl. And 2015, TBD.
We'll find out, I guess. That's the fun of this.
And 2021, when we remember that year.
I'm happy to go ahead. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Can I read a podcast?
What do you have to say? What do you want to say on the podcast, Dad?
Okay, talk.
Hi. What do you
Hi,
want
Tay.
To say? What's your face like that?
What is it, whose face like that? Oh, my on the photo in the on Skype?
Yeah. Well, where's the socks? Did you find socks in the basement? In the owl?
I don't know where socks is right now. He may have gone to the basement. I don't see him.
Well, last time you told, and last time we came to your house, you told me that socks was like hiding in the basement somewhere. Out.
Yeah, yeah. He does that when other people come over. He doesn't like visitors. What'd you do today, Tay?
Nothing.
You're having a good quarantine.
Keep your hand on your mouth.
I'm trying to bite my fingernail.
Most of us don't bite our fingernails while we're podcasting.
That's a little pro tip for you.
Make your phone fart.
Make my phone fart?
Yeah.
All right, say goodnight, Uncle.
Bye.
Good night.
Good night, Tay.
Bye.